leaving Wooddale Church, but to go a long way as missionaries to the country of Bulgaria. You are not only invited to hear what they have to say now, but also Kirk will be ordained as a minister tomorrow night here at Wooddale Church at 6 o'clock, and there will be a reception as part of that. And though that is a public event, a service to which you are invited, but right now, will you please welcome Kirk and Dawn Anderson.
Some of you may remember our faith story from 3 years ago, and we told you that God had called us to be missionaries to Japan. Well, things have changed, so tonight we're going to tell you the rest of the story about how God took us from Japan to Bulgaria. It's a true story, and it goes like this.
Well, wait a minute. Let me start by backing up a little and giving you a brief overview of how we decided to go to Japan in the first place. It all started when Kirk and I took a short-term mission trip to Guatemala with about 40 other Wooddalers. Unfortunately, we were separated for most of the trip, but when we were finally reunited, Kirk greeted me by saying,
"Dawn, I think it's God's plan for us to be missionaries, and I think we should do so right here in Guatemala."
So we went on to share this news with Wooddale's worldwide pastor, Todd Correll. Pastor Correll responded by saying, "Missionaries? That's great! But how about Bulgaria?"
Bulgaria. Well, we read some books, we met some Bulgarians, talked to some missionaries to Bulgaria, and we prayed about it. And it just didn't seem like it was God's plan for us at that time.
Since I had a long-standing interest in Japan, we decided to look into going to Japan as missionaries with an organization called OC International. We wanted to go with OC because of their belief in partnering with the national church and their desire to reach whole nations with the good news of Jesus Christ.
Japan. Okay. So we met with Japanese missionaries and Japanese people, and Dawn even learned some Japanese, and we prayed about it. And it seemed like God was telling us, "Yes, I want you to be missionaries to Japan."
However, after a couple of years of preparing to go to Japan, we started to wonder if God wasn't telling us that we weren't supposed to go to Japan anymore, that this was no longer his plan for us. And so we went back and prayed some more about it.
Well, God's plan became real clear when OC called us to a special meeting. And there they announced to us that they are closing down operations in Japan. Yeah. At first, we thought we'd just go to Japan with a different agency. But God really impressed on our hearts that it was his plan for us to stay with OC International.
Well, now we knew that it was God's plan for us to stay with OC, but we still had to figure out where we were supposed to go. From a human standpoint, it seemed that China was the next best option for us. After all, it was still part of Asia, and I would be able to utilize my nursing skills there.
So we prepared a visit to China in hopes that we'd find out something more about God's plan.
Before we ever even arrived in China, we had already convinced ourselves that this was God's plan for us. After all, how could it not be his plan? Everything seemed perfect. But after we arrived there, we just did not have any sense of peace about being there or doing ministry there. And so, after we had told everyone that we were going to China, we now had to admit that this was not God's plan for us.
So, what was God's plan? Well, with regard to country, we had no idea. So we talked to OC and we talked to Pastor Correll, and Pastor Correll suggests that perhaps Bulgaria is God's plan.
Since nothing else seemed to be working out, we decided to go and visit Bulgaria. While we were there, we had numerous bad experiences. The weather was dreary and bone-chillingly cold. We didn't like the food. We stayed in an apartment where the walls were covered with mold and water was dripping from every pipe, and worst of all, OC was not doing ministry in Bulgaria. Still, somehow we returned from the trip feeling like it was God's plan for us to go to Bulgaria. But it took some getting used to.
So, one of the big things for us is that we wanted to be with OC, and we thought that God was telling us we should be with OC. So we approached OC and asked them to consider beginning work in Bulgaria. After 3 months of conversations, they came back with their answer, yes. And that was a confirmation that we were to stay with OC and go as missionaries to Bulgaria.
Fortunately, this past May, we were able to take another trip to Bulgaria with some of OC's leaders. This just further confirmed for us that Bulgaria was God's plan for us.
The church in Bulgaria is very small. Just about 1% of the population is followers of Jesus Christ. But God is doing some exciting things in Bulgaria. He's united those churches around a shared vision of church planting and church growth, and he's given a missionary vision to Bulgarian leadership, that they might take the good news of Jesus Christ to Turkey and to Macedonia and other surrounding countries. Dawn and I will be plugging into those two movements of God by helping mentor young Bulgarian leaders and helping to facilitate Bulgaria's own mission movement throughout Bulgaria, the Balkans, and beyond.
This has been a long and sometimes confusing journey for Kirk and I, but we know that God has led us to this point. And now, Kirk and I are excited that we have both finally heard God's plan at the same time about the same country.
Bulgaria!
Dawn, come on back. We want to pray for them. Will you stand as we pray? Father, how grateful we are for Kirk and Dawn and for your direction in their lives. It has been sort of a roundabout journey, but it is the destination and following you that is most important. And so now, as a church family, we bless them, we commission them, we send them, we encourage them, we promise them our support and our prayers and our very best, expecting from them faithfulness and effectiveness for Jesus Christ. Send them well for great results. In Jesus' name, amen. Be seated, please. George Bernard Shaw said it first, and it was Robert F. Kennedy that made the quote most famous, that some see the way things are and ask why. Others look at the way things could be and ask, why not? It is the difference of vision. Some see the possibilities and some see the impossibilities. In the movie Pearl Harbor is the scene where the Japanese bombers come in, devastating the Pacific Fleet of the United States and rapidly bringing this country into World War II. There is a scene in that movie that is set in the war room at the White House in Washington, D.C., where President Franklin D. Roosevelt, seated in a wheelchair, urges the military and political leaders of the country to plan a retaliatory attack against Japan. Deep into the Japanese homeland, a painful attack to say that they, too, were vulnerable. But the military and political leaders say it can't be done. It just can't be done. Nehemiah was another man of great vision, a man who refused to be told that it cannot be done. His story is one of the most fascinating and one of the most readable in the entire Bible. It is set in the year 444 BC, nearly a century and a half after Jerusalem was destroyed and the Hebrew people were carried away into captivity in Babylon. There were some Jews who returned in the year 538 BC, but many of them, in fact, most of them, remained captives and exiles in distant lands, and among those were Nehemiah. Now, although he was a Jew, an expatriate, amazingly, he became the cupbearer to the king, Artaxerxes, the emperor of Persia. It is astounding that he should rise to such a high level. A cupbearer, historically, was the person who tasted the king's food and drank the king's wine before he ate and drank. And if it was poison, then you didn't lose the king. You have the idea. He takes a sip of the king's wine. If he drops dead, then the king skips dinner that night. But the cupbearer became something far more. Obviously, this person had to be trusted as much or more than anyone else in the entire court. And became one of the most important and trusted advisors to the king. One day, some Jewish men from Jerusalem visited the Persian royal palace in Susa, and they came to talk to Nehemiah. And Nehemiah asked, well, how are things back in Jerusalem? And here's what they told him. Those who survived the exile are back in the province. They are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. For Nehemiah, vision was seeing the way things were. And although he was an empire away, he had something clear in his mind of what Jerusalem looked like. It was pathetic, it was sad, and it broke his heart. And so Nehemiah, seeing from such a great distance, broke down and cried. He wept. It's an interesting insight into his leadership. that here was a man who was in a palace with power and prestige, with money and comfort, and yet he wept over the poverty of people a long ways away. There are some who are rich who gloat over the poor, but Nehemiah wept. Vision was seeing the way things were, but vision was also, for Nehemiah, seeing the way things might be. And so he dreamed. He dreamed of a better Jerusalem, a place where righteous people would live according to God's law, a place where the slums would be replaced by rebuilt houses, a place where there would be new gates that would swing in and out, and a new wall that would protect and be sturdy. And it was a bold dream. But Nehemiah knew that dreams without action are nothing. And so with a boldness that would take your breath away, Nehemiah moved from vision to doing something. He started out by going to God with an outrageous idea. He talked to God about the outrageous idea that he would go to King Artaxerxes and ask permission and help in order to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. But in those days, a cupbearer never asked the king for any personal favor. That was not his place nor his role, and to do so was to risk his life. So he got down on his face before God, and here's what he prayed. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I believe that there are a whole lot more great visions that would actually turn into reality if visionaries would start out where Nehemiah started, and that is with prayer and reverence for God. And so with his heart just pounding, just riddled with fear from top to bottom, he went into the presence of Artaxerxes and asked him for a leave of absence, asked him for letters of authority to operate under his name, and asked him for financial support to pay for the project. Must have wondered what Artaxerxes would think. That this was perhaps a traitorous request. That he was trying to just get away from the place of captivity. That he was trying to get money. That he was trying to line his own pockets. That he was actually a man in rebellion. It was a risky request. But Artaxerxes amazingly said yes. But in the thinking and in the faith of Nehemiah, it wasn't because Artaxerxes was some generous monarch. As Nehemiah said, it was because the gracious hand of my God was upon me. And that's why the king granted my request. So Nehemiah recruited a caravan that included soldiers and supplies, planners and workers, and headed out toward Jerusalem. And he may have expected that when he would arrive in Jerusalem with his entourage, that the people would shout and cheer and be absolutely thrilled, and everybody would rally around him. Actually, that isn't what happened. When he arrived in Jerusalem, he met critics, people who were angry with him for what he was trying to do, people who mocked him, people who tried to humiliate him. They accused him of treason. They said that he was trying to become the king. They actually sought to get, and at some point got, restraining orders to control his behavior. And when nothing else seemed to work, they threatened him with physical violence. And that was when Nehemiah discovered something that every visionary faces, every visionary, and that is opposition. So you know, maybe from your own experience at work or home or school or wherever, that if you have a bold idea, if you have a new scheme, a better way of doing something, if you have a notion for God that is great, you will face criticism and you will face misunderstanding and opposition. There are some people who will laugh. There are other people who will criticize. There are some people who will get absolutely angry and threatened, because all visions face inevitable opposition. And strangely, sometimes the greatest opposition comes from the very people who are trying to be helped. I don't know how you respond when things like that happen. I guess my inevitable response is that opposition and criticism gets me down. It discourages me. It makes me want to quit. And that's precisely why I, and probably we, need to learn from Nehemiah. Here's how he answered his critics. He said, "The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding, but as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it." In other words, Nehemiah said, this is a God-given vision, and God's going to make it succeed, and if you don't want to be part of it, then you don't have to be part of it. Good for Nehemiah. Facing the critics, he learned as a leader and as a visionary, is part of the vision process. Now, don't get the wrong impression. When talking about him as a visionary and as a leader, Nehemiah, although he has a book of the Bible named after him, absolutely did not do this alone. Because it takes a whole population to rebuild a city, to construct a wall, and everyone in Jerusalem, well, almost everyone, gathered to do their part. Some of them were carpenters and some of them were masons, but some of them were goldsmiths and perfumers. Many of them brought their sons along to work by their side in this reconstruction project, but there were some that didn't have sons, so they brought their daughters. And it was their daughters who worked to reconstruct the wall. If you have read Nehemiah chapter 3, you have read one of the greatest stories of teamwork in the entire Bible. I just want to pick some lines out of it. It says that Eliashib the high priest and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. The fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hasanah. The next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa. Their nobles would not put their shoulder to the work under their supervisors. So the rich and the upper class, they didn't want to work. So what happened? The others did their work for them. The valley gate was repaired by Hanan and the residents of Zenoa. The dung gate was repaired by Malchijah, the son of Rechab. How would you like to go down in the Bible and in history as the dung gate guy? I mean, you're the one that did the dung gate. Well, somebody had to do it, and they did what needed to be done. And then the list goes on. And as you read through Nehemiah chapter 3, it is gate after gate, section after section, all the way around the entire city of Jerusalem. And almost every sentence begins with a line, next to him, and then next to him, and next to them, and next to them. So they stood side by side in tackling the fulfillment of this amazing vision. There's only one way to make that kind of a vision come true, and that is by sharing the work. Now, was it easy? It wasn't easy. Absolutely not. In fact, it became so dangerous that they had to go to work every day with their tools in one hand and their weapons in the other hand. It got so dangerous that at times they had to take people off of the workforce in order to put them on guard duty because the threats of the opposition was so great. But they did whatever they needed to do in order to make this happen. Now, in the middle of this project, Nehemiah was confronted with a huge difficulty. There was a famine in the land. There was enormous unemployment. People mortgaged their homes. They borrowed money. There was heavy taxation that was coming from the Persian government, and the nobles were underpaying just about everyone. And people were crumbling under their poverty, and Nehemiah had to choose whether he would ignore the needs of the people and go on with the vision or stop the vision out of compassion. And he decided to do what was right. A fascinating line in the Bible. He decided to do what was right, and what was right was to trust God to do both at the same time. You see, there are some visionaries who are so bent on the vision that they don't care about the needs of the people, and there are others that are so compassionate that they forget about the vision of God. Not Nehemiah. Nehemiah committed that he would do what was right for God until the vision became reality. The wall and the city were rebuilt in 52 days. They had laid in ruins for a century and a half and were rebuilt in about a month and a half. And the report of this is one of the most inspiring in the Bible in Nehemiah 6. The wall was completed on the 25th of the month of Elul in 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. So what had happened? Well, the vision had come true. And the enemies and the critics had realized too late that they had missed out on being part of something that was a great work of God. And when they realized this, their self-esteem and their self-confidence just plummeted. But what happened to the people that participated in God's great vision? You know what happened. Their self-esteem and their self-confidence skyrocketed. And in the process of all of this, they gave great credit to God. You see, Nehemiah had looked at the way things were, but did not ask why. He saw the way Jerusalem could be, and he asked, why not? 60 years ago, a small group of Richfield, Minnesota residents started a Bible study in a VFW hall and dreamed of it becoming an interdenominational church. They were very few in number, and they had minimal resources, but they had a vision from God. And their response to the vision from God was, why not? And they founded the Wayside Chapel. They bought two lots at the corner of 71st and Nicollet Avenue in Richfield with 500 borrowed dollars. And they hoped that for the Wayside Chapel, they could build a church building, but they had absolutely no money, and there was no bank that was willing to lend them anything at all. And so, in a step of faith that touches my heart even now, 60 years later, the people of that tiny congregation went to savings and loan associations, and they took out second mortgages on their homes, and they gave all of the money in its entirety and pooled it together so they could build a place for this little church to meet. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough. All they were able to do was dig a hole in the ground and build a basement with a roof on the top. The only thing that stuck up above the ground was the staircase that went down under the ground. And that was their church building. They changed the name of their church from Wayside Chapel to match Richfield's name for that neighborhood of the Wooddale Addition. That Wooddale church then called a pastor and began to reach out into the community until more people came, and eventually they were able to finance a small chapel with laminated beams that sat maybe 125 or so people. It took them 20 years before they could finally build the worship center in 1964, and that congregation grew on 9/10 of an acre to be almost 1,000 people with 14 parking spaces. They were very crowded cars. Now, almost all of those pioneers are now gone, but what they saw was a church. They envisioned Jesus Christ touching people's lives, and they imagined what could be and said, why not? They had this first vision that came true. But that first vision had actually gone far beyond the dreams of their pioneers. And when it became a reality, the church that they had started became a comfortable place, comfortable and successful. And when we become comfortable and successful, it is time for a fresh vision. So during the 1970s and the early 1980s, God started some new dreams. It was a fresh vision. It was a fresh vision of becoming an outreaching church. And it shaped into a vision of a new ministry in a new place with a new name, reaching new people for Jesus Christ. Now, that was hard for some because their roots were deep and the sacrifices they had made were enormous to be there. They feared the change. They were pleased to be part of a congregation that was giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to missions that felt that they already had enough people and that it was all far too expensive to start out on a new vision. Such a difficult change that there were those who said, it cannot be done. But that fresh vision was deeply rooted in the belief that the hope of the world is the church of Jesus Christ. That if the church can be and do what Jesus Christ wants it to be and do, it is formidable in its power to transform people and society like nothing else. And so there was a fresh vision. A fresh vision that brought Wooddale Church to a 31-acre parcel at the corner of Shady Oak Road and Flying Cloud Drive, later renamed Bryant Lake Drive, in Eden Prairie. It was a move of three towns and 9 miles away. And there were some who worried that when that move actually took place, nobody would show up. And the reason I know is because I was one of those with that worry. The first weekend here, the first service in this room, was on the 22nd of July in 1984. I came early that morning, and I wondered if nobody else would show up. The building was smaller than the building that was left behind by 7,000 square feet. There was no worship center. There were few offices. There were minimal classrooms, and it was a huge financial undertaking of almost $3 million. But that fresh vision turned out to be an indescribable blessing of God. It turned out that God had a vision that was far greater than anyone else had ever dreamed. The hundreds of people became thousands of people. The vision became a vision for starting a half dozen new churches as daughter churches around the metropolitan area that today have more than 10,000 people who are part of those six churches. Giving to missionaries skyrocketed from thousands of dollars every year to millions of dollars every year. A powerful youth ministry and marvelous children's programs and adult classes and small groups and women's ministry and ministries to the disabled and a bookstore and sports and a national radio program. Things that God had envisioned that never even had been thought of. For it seems that God had looked at Wooddale Church with a fresh vision and he had said, why not? Why not? But vision is always about the future. Vision is never about the past. Vision is about, in our personal lives and in our church lives, always looking to tomorrow. Tomorrow. That is at the very essence of what Christianity is all about. Even on our deathbeds as Christians, we are looking to tomorrow with hope. That's what Christians do. The future vision for Wooddale Church is perhaps best described in the statement of purpose to honor God by making more disciples for Jesus Christ. It is a vision that includes more new churches throughout the state of Minnesota, ministries that reach all the way to those infected with AIDS in Africa, a vision of leveraging an outstanding youth ministry with better meeting rooms, a vision of new classes and new classrooms, of discipleship and evangelism, of parking and prayer. And when the church talks about a future vision, again, there are multiple responses. There is always the temptation, it is a lingering thought in my own heart, to say, but you know, I'm just not sure that that can be done. And then I hear echoing the words of Nehemiah, the God of heaven will give us success. Do you consider yourself to be a person of vision? I want you to think of a number. Just pick any number and hold it in your mind for just a moment. Got the number? Did you pick a number smaller or larger than a million? And if you chose a number less than a million, why did you pick a number that was so small? In 1998, two Stanford University graduate students, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, incorporated an internet search engine. Last year, their search engine performed over 150 million searches per day, accessing 2 billion pages of information in 74 different languages with an average use of 13 million hours per month. Their search engine is nearly 3 times larger than the number 2 search engine, Yahoo. Now, if you use the internet, if you have a computer, you already know and you've guessed that it is the wildly popular search engine, Google. Now, Google is a mathematical term for a 1 followed by 100 zeros. These guys started small, but let me tell you, they had one big vision. Now, I'll tell you what we typically do when we pick a number. You and I usually pick a number like 7 or 17, or some of us are just wildly enthusiastic and we pick 93. But as disciples of Jesus Christ, we belong to the Lord of the universe, the King of Kings, the omnipotent God. And he is the one that gives to us vision. So may we have vision and faith that comes from the God of Google and infinitely more. Our God of Google and infinitely more, we trust you. And we pray that you will give to us your vision for us and for our families, for our community and nation, and give to us your vision for this church. And when you've given us your vision, may we say together in unison with you, why not? For Jesus' sake.